Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Ben Reed, and tonight we are continuing Jonathan Johnson's memoir, The Desk on the Sea. For those of you who are just now joining us, Jonathan wrote The Desk on the Sea during his time in Scotland with his family as he mourned his mother's death. In tonight's episode, Jonathan, Amy, and Anya reach the end of Harry Potter, a story which had been for them a map, a tradition, and an adventure.
Today is Mother's Day in the U.S. Mother's Day somewhere else. That fits. Today, I give bitterness its due. Here is the Scottish coast, the still surface of the North Sea in sunshine. Here are the fishing boats just offshore. And today is a Mother's Day my mother doesn't get. For all the superhuman optimism and kindness and gratitude with which my mother lived her life, that life was taken from her, slowly, painfully, inch by gangrened, infected, throbbing inch, as she watched. How many times I remember she held up her hands to show me how far the darkness had moved down a finger, or where a finger had been taken to another knuckle. This, after nothingness rose like a tide to take her feet. And on the merry world rolls without her. For British Mothering Sunday, up on the shore of Loch Shiel back in March, I had heart. I felt an optimism and gratitude befitting my mother's son. Today, I come up short of my mother's grace. Today, I have only loyalty to her. Let me be an exile from a day that does not have her. For the sake of Amy, to whom such holidays matter, and whom I love through every bitterness, and who is a wonderful mom, I'll join Anya in marking the day with flowers, a card, dinner out in St. Andrews. For those I love, I will do as my mother must have done countless times for me, and muster a geniality from the gloom. But in the solitary world of my heart, I permit myself the weakness to begrudge the world for the nothing it has today to give her. 4,224 pages. The Harry Potter series, start to finish. Last night, Anya, Amy, and I sat cross-legged on Anya's bed. Usually, we're snuggled in when we read, but not last night. Last night was the end, the arrival. No way Anya was going to just lie down. In fact, when she came upstairs to read, she did a little somersault on her bed. Better yet, she wanted us to take turns reading. We made our way toward the end, each of us reading a page, then passing the giant, open volume along. Anya needed a little help with emphasized, but she got inherited, evidently and ecstatically, with only the slightest hesitation. This is the last month of her 8th year. We've been reading the books to her off and on since she was 5. More than a third of her life. Way more than half of the life she remembers. "What's Little Lamb think of us getting to the end of the books?" I asked. She had her constant companion tucked under her arm. Things were getting tense. Which beloved characters would live and which would die? "She's fine. She says the books are a side thing to our plays." "She's right," Amy offered, "and I think J.K. Rowling would very much approve of that." Amy added that, just like other characters who died in earlier books, anyone who didn't survive in this last installment would go right on living in our games. "I know," Anya said, "but let's read now, okay?" And so on we pressed and learned, with a few tears, who does and who does not survive. And then we came to the epilogue, a little glimpse into how life goes on in the future. Into every third sentence or so, Rowling had planted reasons for delight and satisfaction, for the belief in a world that remakes itself from its past. Rowling lost her own mother when she was just starting the first book. She has spoken about how that loss goes on. She said she regrets that her mother never knew Harry. I regret that mine didn't either. She'd have found a lot to like in the fellow orphan who builds a new life based on love. And she'd have played right along with Amy, Anya, and me. She would have made an excellent Professor McGonagall. But, like Amy and me, Rowling also has children of her own. New souls for whom this new world is the only world there is. The comfort of life's perpetual renewal, the only lasting comfort there is, really, is the truth she wrote into her epic's final scene. The world's new children are the next protagonists, the great and ongoing story's next heroes. As it happened, the very last page of the book arrived on Anya's turn to read. While she read it, I thought about all the places we've tucked her into bed and read from Harry's story. Her bedroom back in Washington State, the gable bedroom atop Amy's parents' log house in Upper Michigan, the bedroom in which my mother died in Marquette. We finished the third book in the loft of our tiny Idaho cabin by headlamp because the cabin doesn't have electricity. On all fours as a stag, Anya had jumped back and forth between the loft beds while I'd read, and we'd learned which characters had all along been able to change into animals. We'd read it in hotel rooms in London, Paris, Dublin, and Venice, in an Irish farmhouse, in motels in Montana. We've stood beside the loch where filmmakers set Hogwarts Castle, and on the knoll on which they built Hagrid's hut. We found the luggage trolley disappearing into Platform 9 3/4 in King's Cross Station. Been to Edinburgh's Elephant House tea room, where much of the first two books got written, and ran around on broomsticks in our American backyard. Back in the Washington bedroom, where we started our reading 4 years ago, I've painted the walls with mountains towering over a Quidditch pitch, Hagrid's hut, and the Lochside Castle. The castle windows I painted with glow-in-the-dark paint, and I did the same for the sun above. When we turn out Anya's light, the sun becomes the shining moon, and the windows of Hogwarts glow invitingly. The books have given us an imaginative life we can share, a sense of wonder about the world. We've walked through shopping malls playing Muggle or Wizard as we pass other shoppers. Hint: teenage kids with dyed hair and dressed in lots of black are always witches or wizards. Driving Anya to school, I've pushed and pushed the red defrost button on the dash while Amy rolled her eyes and said, "Ronald, haven't you gotten that invisibility booster fixed yet?" While we've driven Anya up to her Highland dance class in St. Andrews, she's howled from the back seat, paused, and said, "It's Professor McGonagall as a cat, and she does not like riding in cars." I'm loyal to the former world in which my mother lived, but I also love this life of ours, this new world in which we live, into which my mother wished us, as all parents wish their children. I only wish I could show her more of this new story, the story in which Anya is the hero, than the little epilogue we got. Last night, in our snug Scottish cottage, where we finished the last of the last book, when Anya was finally under the Harry Potter quilt Amy's mother had made for her, and we'd kissed her forehead, and Amy'd told her sweet dreams and gone downstairs, and when I'd clicked off the lamp, I stood in her doorway and said, "Good night, Harry."
"Good night, Ron,"
she returned with a satisfied, drowsy sigh. All through May, the harbor has grown steadily busier with sightseers. Yesterday was bright and warm, and there were even more than usual, photographing boats, one another on the seawall, the Isle of May on the horizon, our cottage. Whenever I looked up from my writing desk, I wondered if any of them were the next renters, a couple from Denmark here to see their new home. What would they look like? The harbor was crawling with couples. They have two young boys, but they'd left them behind for their reconnaissance trip. And then there they were, no doubt about it. Tall and lanky, about the same age as Amy and me, they stood at the bottom of the stairs to our front garden and took in the cottage. He had long hair and a beard. She had short blonde hair. They both had looks of wonderment at their good fortune. He raised his hand, and she paid him a high five. If a 370-some-year-old cottage teaches you anything, it teaches you that, sooner or later, we are all replaced. I opened the window and leaned out. "I bet I know who you are," I called down. The delight on Morton and Maria's faces never faded as we showed them around. The narrow stone fireplace in the snug little living room, the tiny kitchen with its tiny fridge and big wooden table for six, the bathtub with the view to the harbor and sea, the same view out Anya's bedroom window above the little window seat on which she's sat so many nights to tell the Isle of May lighthouse goodnight, my desk at our bedroom window, the tiny guest cottage out back, the terraced back garden with its view out over the cottage chimneys to fishing boats working the lobster pots out past the seawall. In 2 months, it would all be theirs. Amy and I sat at the kitchen table over tea with them and told them the fishermen are reticent, or okay, curmudgeonly. But when they see you walking out the door with your child in a Crail school uniform, they'll know you're not just on holiday, and they'll start to nod or even say hello. We told them the best place to get acquainted with people in the village is at the school gate. Carl the mechanic is fair and good, I said, though between his accent and yours, you won't understand much of what each other says. They laughed. They were enchanted. A new life. Like me, Morton's a professor with a year sabbatical to devote to his own work. Like Amy, Maria's a mom excited, but a little anxious about how she'll make friends and fill her time. They both wonder how their kids will get on. The world replaces us all. My mom trusted and welcomed that about the world. It was something she loved about academic life. The cars with their hazards flashing and trunks open on the sidewalks beside the dorms every autumn and again every spring. Human beings taking places left them by human beings who depart. She had faith in how the world was made. If the human seasons saddened or frightened her, she rarely, if ever, said so. Instead, she spoke often of the comfort she found in the cycles that create and take us. Amy wants to go home more than I do. Like Anya, she's ready for our house, our old friends, the feel of American coins in her hand, the right-hand side of wide roads. So I was surprised when she told me how hard it was for her to think of being replaced here. This is our little cottage, our village. But you want to go home. I know. It still bothers me to think of someone else here, though. I can't help it. I get that, I said as we lay in bed, our curtains open to the lighthouse blinking, the inky sea, and a sky that grows more stubborn in its refusal to go dark every night. It makes me happy to think of them here, though. Did you hear Morton? He says, man. In his Dutch accent, he's addressed me with the term. This place is unbelievable, man. As anyone who knows me can tell you, man is one of my favorite terms of address. Morton and Maria will bathe their kids in this tub. They'll make love in this bed and wake to the waves out this window. They'll argue in the kitchen over the same tiny steel sink. They'll meet friends in the village. And when one of those friends comes over for dinner, Morton will address him as man. Meanwhile, the sun comes out from behind the clouds for at least a little while every day. Meanwhile, we have a little less than 2 months in which to live the last of our lives here, in which to let the end that is coming teach us each day that remains. There's a photo we keep on our fridge back in Washington of Cousin Jennifer as a smiling towhead of about 3 on a pony. When Anya first noticed the picture, she was just a little older than Jennifer was at the time it was taken, and she asked when she'd been on that horse. They look that much like older and younger versions of each other. There's enough difference in their ages that they never squabble. Jennifer's an adult and became so about the time she moved in with us as a college freshman. Anya can look up to her in an uncomplicated way in which a child can admire someone completely beyond her own stage of development. But Jennifer's also the most playful, guileless adult I know. She's completely at home, spending hours playing Harry Potter or making forts on the rocky shore or holding a rope as a musher behind Anya as a sled dog tugging her around the house. Having Jennifer with us here has taken a little of the homesickness from Anya's spring. To Anya, Jennifer shines as a sister. Now, though, Jennifer was headed off for a 6-week backpacking tour around Europe, and Anya was distraught. After we said goodbye at the train station near St. Andrews, she bawled inconsolably. I miss her, she sobbed from the back seat as I drove the twisty road toward Crail through the seemingly eternal dusk. I do too, sweetie, Amy agreed. Me too, I said. But we'll all be together again in the fall. But just for one more year, then she'll be gone and never live with us again. Anya is coming to that age at which, more and more, she feels the weight of even distant eventualities. Maybe you'll move in with her when you're in college, I offered. But right away, I knew I'd said the wrong thing. I don't want to leave you, she cried. No, no, you wouldn't have to. Daddy just means she'll go on being part of our family. You two will have each other all your lives. And it was true. God willing, Anya and Jennifer will live a long time. And after Amy and I and the other people older than them and our families have gone, Anya and Jennifer will have each other to remember by, and to know in that thorough, lifelong way of siblings. I don't want her to go, Anya wept on and wasn't to be consoled. It's horrible to hear your child cry. The urge to make it better right away is biological and overwhelming. It was all I could do to focus on the road curving through woods and along stone walls through the long dusk. It's particularly torturous when your child cries for an inescapable sorrow she's just apprehended is woven into the very fabric of existence, the sorrow that sooner or later we lose one another. But as hard as it was to hear Anya grieve, I also rejoiced a little inside. She was grieving because she loves. The three of us were cozy in the little cottage living room. Amy'd been dealing the cards for an evening game of There's a Moose in the House. Anya and I had cooling mugs of hot chocolate. Then the phone rang in the kitchen. It was an old friend calling from America to see how I'm holding up as word of the movie Bright Star starts to get out. Fine tonight until this call was the truth. I'd wanted nothing more than to hang up mid-sentence, as if we'd been cut off, and go back to the living room and pretend the phone had never rung. But a friend who has known you half your life and still believes in you, even or especially when you're knocked down, is rare and precious. So I called out to Amy and Anya I'd be a minute and sat down at the kitchen table and proceeded to tell my friend that sometimes it was every bit as bad as she might guess. After I'd hung up and was back at the card game, Anya asked me what was just as bad as my friend might guess. Just a writing thing, I explained, and promised to tell her about it later. I laid down a moose card in her mother's house and did my best to gloat convincingly. Later came, and as I put away our clean cocoa mugs and wiped down the kitchen counter, to my surprise, Anya remembered to ask me about my complaint. Well, I sighed. Remember all those pages taped to my office walls back home? I was writing a movie, one I'd been planning to write ever since I became an adult. It was about a true story, one nobody had ever made a movie of before. And then, a few months ago, I was finally almost done when I found out that somebody else had just made a movie of the same story, their version of the same story. I read her face as she took it all in, listening and considering intently. I've been really, really sad about it, really sad. But I'm still happy deep down, because I have you and Mama, and we have these wonderful days in Scotland. Her lips pursed and her eyes reddened. Daddy, tears rolled down her cheeks. She sobbed and hugged me. I grew up with you writing that movie. Oh, baby, it's all right. I'm disappointed, but it'll be okay. Why did someone else get to write it? It's not fair. You said it, kid. Brutally unfair. That voice was in my head. But Anya's thin arms squeezed me tighter, and I heard another voice. A good life. What your parents do about their own suffering can reveal depths in them beyond who they manage to be for you when they are safe and comfortable. I loved my mother as a woman of great patience and kindness. Then they began to cut pieces off of her, and I met a soul of exquisite grace and wisdom. And the amputation of my screenplay dream, of any dream, no matter how deep its sinews go, is hardly the amputation of a foot. We grow new dreams. I'm jealous of the person who got to have her movie made, I confessed. But you know what else? I admire her, too. She must be someone I'd like a lot if she also wanted to tell that story. And even though nobody will want to make another movie about it right now, I made mine into a play. And now I'm writing it as a book, a novel. I added a conspiratorial, shh. Countless times, she's heard me say I don't talk about what I'm working on. Amy ducked in through the doorway. She'd been listening. I feel the same way as you, Anya. It just crushes me. But I'm so glad you're empathetic with Daddy and what disappoints him. It isn't fair. No, it isn't. It's just really bad luck, I offered. With another squeeze, Anya released me. And for something to do with myself, I went back to wiping the counters while we talked. What's the story? It's about John Keats, one of my two favorite poets, and how he fell in love with the girl next door, whose name was Fanny Braun. But then he got very sick and died. Why do you want to write about something sad? Good question. In fact, she'd gotten right to the heart of things. How come? Well, we learn things about people when they're sad. And it's not all sad, not deep down. I sat down and hoisted her onto my knee. Keats got sick and died, but he learned to love. Everyone dies, but not everyone learns to love. It's very hard for some people. Why? She wanted to know, but I also recognized she had and wanted to keep such thorough attention from me, wanted to engage me on this level, close to my adult heart. Well, sometimes they're afraid of losing people. Keats's daddy died when he was a boy, and then his mom. An orphan, like my mother. I've devoted the best of my imagination to him for years because of the beauty of his poetry, but also in an attempt to understand how a soul grows from such loss and grief to become so enormous and embracing. And his brother died too, Amy added. If nobody else ever comes to know my Keats and Fanny, Amy knows them from reading draft after draft. I've got to keep living with Keats and Fanny, I explained to Anya. So I keep writing, no matter what, until I know them as well as I can. Like J.K. Rowling with Harry, Ron, and Hermione, she said. Yeah, like J.K. Rowling with Harry, Ron, and Hermione. She gave me another squeeze. I'm sorry, Daddy. Thank you, Bug. It was past her bedtime, but I told her if she'd get her PJs on and teeth brushed right away, I'd tell a story. I was beaten and sad, and Anya was powerless to stop that. But the parent she saw, the parent I found in myself, refused to be bitter or defeated. Then, when I turned out the kitchen light and stood and listened to the creaks of her and Amy climbing the stairs, it occurred to me that maybe Anya wasn't powerless in the face of my suffering after all. Maybe she was essential to my transcendence. Maybe I'd been essential to my mother's. Pocket Journal Entry, Marquette, Day 6. February 7, morning. It's been snowing since Amy, Anya, and I arrived in Marquette, and it continues to snow. Why should Mom have to die in the grip of winter? She who so loves the sun and flowers? She cannot go outside, has not been able to all week. I was up a great deal of the night. My sister Anne and Dad and me with Mom, Dad beside her, Anne lying on the floor, me in a chair, all of us saying over and over, "It's okay, we're here, we love you," like a mantra as she breathed hard and seemed so scared beneath her furrowed brow. Then she'd settle for a while. Once she said, "Your voices, good." Finally, we all slept a few hours. I thought that we were at the end, but here it is, late morning, and her life goes on. I will write her obituary today, by her side. Scotland, late spring and early summer. Anya is 9. Amy and I brought her and 3 of her school friends down to Edinburgh on the train for a birthday celebration of Anya's design. The playground in Princess Street Gardens beneath the city's hilltop castle, a stuffed animal store, Starbucks for hot chocolate. As the girls laughed and held hands and ran ahead on park paths and city sidewalks, I watched to learn what 9 might mean for my daughter. What I saw was empathy. One of the girls was lagging behind, maybe feeling a little excluded by the others or maybe not, but falling behind nonetheless. Anya turned, called back to her friend, and waited while the girl trotted to catch up. It was a tiny thing, something anyone but a child's parents would be unlikely to notice, but it made my day. Anya's version of 9 is off to a start full of privilege, opportunity, and easy good times, for which I am profoundly grateful. By American and British financial standards, we're barely middle class. But I've got a fantastic job that's paying for us to be in Scotland, and that lets Amy and me spend money on our daughter as only a tiny percentage of this world's parents can. These living daydreams, though, grateful as I am for them, don't even come close to what I most want to give my daughter. What I most want to give her And what I'm determined she must never confuse for trips or horse lessons is, of course, and simply, love. That spiritually essential feeling that her parents love her, without reservation or complication, wholly and forever. Love in childhood teaches you that you belong in this world for the rest of your life. It opens you to compassion and trust and new loves of your own. Our young family friend, Brianna, the daughter of the minister who 15 summers ago married Amy and me, has come to visit from America. She's a favorite of Anya's, and she brought her a birthday gift, a fisherman-style cap she's been working on making for months. In the cottage kitchen, she played Happy Birthday on fiddle while Amy and I sang. Anya blew out the candles on her cake, on which I'd spent an hour drawing a colored frosting fox. The kind of love my mother showed me is infinitely harder to measure than stuffed toys or fancy hot chocolate or even handmade hats and hand-decorated cakes, and infinitely more valuable. And it's the one gift I am most determined to give Anya.
Thank you for listening to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. If you missed an episode, you can catch up online at spokanepublicradio.org or on the Bookshelf podcast. That marks the end of tonight's episode of The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. The music for this episode is by Caerdwin and Greg Spatz. I'm Ben Reed.